Welcome, everyone, to the Take Control of Your Health podcast. This is Dr. Mercola bringing you the latest cutting-edge interviews to help you achieve optimal health. You can receive more information by subscribing to my free daily newsletter at mercola.com. Because you won't find us on Google or Facebook, we respect your privacy and will continue to fight the Silicon Valley censorship. Thank you so much for listening. So let's get started with this week's latest program to help you and your family take control of your health. So welcome, everyone. This is Dr. Mercola helping you take control of your health. And today we are honored to be joined by Dr. Peter Breggin, who has a very illustrious career. And I would categorize him as one of the true medical heroes. One of the people who's no longer with us is David Bowie, an icon in the music industry, and he had the song Heroes, which is one of my favorites. And what is a hero? A hero is someone with the multiple C characteristics. And what are those? Courageous. And I want to explore what makes Dr. Breggin so courageous. Why was he able to do what he's done? And we'll discuss what he's done, and he'll summarize it very shortly. But I want you to know he's a massive hero. He's confident, and he really knows the difference between knowing and believing. When you know something at the fundamental rate, and he's clever and creative. So when you combine all these with a passion, you really can become a hero. And he's done this for four decades. He's a psychiatrist. He did his residency training at Harvard, taught there, and he taught at Johns Hopkins. And he's done a lot of work, and actually has over a dozen best-selling books on psychiatry, and he's been appeared in major media channels like Oprah, 60 Minutes, 2020, Larry King. And he's frequently referred to as the conscience of psychiatry because he's been able to successfully reform the medical health field. And probably what he's best well known for, and what really, to me, puts him in the hero field, is his ability, it's characteristic of being the first physician to come out against lobotomy. Yes, lobotomies. And he's going to describe what that is in case you weren't aware of it already, and psychosurgery. And he was the first to take a public stand about it. And he was a young man at the time and really stood up against giants in the field. And it just amazes me to have the courage and the confidence to do that at such a young age. I mean, it's just incredible. And he changed the whole industry as a result. I mean, these people took the brains of 50,000 people. They just took them. And it's just remarkable that prior to Dr. Breggin, no one really professionally posed them. So I've known of him for a while, but I really became reacquainted with him because he did a one-hour interview with Aaron and Melissa from TruthStream Media. And they did an excellent documentary called The Minds of Men, and we'll link to that in this video. And he was really the star of the film, but Aaron and Melissa do such a great job of exposing many of these conspiracies of health. So this is a long intro, but Dr. Breggin's going to be doing most of the talking in this interview because he's an excellent speaker. He could talk it for hours on any topic. And I asked him if he'd be kind enough to summarize his over four decades. I mean, he's 83 years old now, and he's been practicing since I was still in grade school. So has a very, very illustrious career. So I want to, with all that background and introduction, I want to welcome you and thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much. You know, I rarely actually do this. I have my own radio TV show once a week where I could at any time do it on my own. And I never done it on the radio TV. And it's just a hard thing to do by myself, I think. Yeah, but I'll thank you so much, and I'll jump right on in. I mean, I was 18 years old. I was a Harvard freshman, and a friend of mine said, "Peter, you're studying all the time. My brother and I are starting this volunteer program at the local state mental hospital," and I went out to the local state mental hospital, and it was a nightmare. It immediately, as I stepped on the wards of these giant buildings, not tall, two, three stories. multiple giant buildings up on a hill, looking down over a small town, 15 miles outside of Cambridge, maybe. And when I walked in, it was my Uncle Dutch's descriptions of liberating a Nazi concentration camp. The place stank. People were sitting in these bare, barren corridors, which were called wards. They really were concrete corridors. They had a TV set that wasn't working up on a wall and bolted down tables and chairs so people couldn't throw them at each other. No attention being given to them at all. Often just sitting, some hallucinating. And somebody told me that the girl in the corner curled up in a ball on a floor by a radiator had been a Radcliffe student. In those days, Harvard and Radcliffe were sister schools. You could go, the women went to Radcliffe and the men went to Harvard in those days. And I looked around, and I can't tell you exactly why, Joe, but my thought was, there, but for the grace of God, go I. And I think it's that there was that inner sense that I knew how hard life was. I knew how my adolescent years had been so difficult, even though it was very successful. I got into Harvard. I knew inside my vulnerability, and I knew that if things had gone a little different, I could have been there. And when I visited with the people, what was so apparent was they were people. They weren't schizophrenics or whatever, involutional melancholics in those days for depressed women. They were folks, and they were most of them so glad to see a young person, a Harvard student, in the wards. It was like I found a calling. I wouldn't have thought of it then that way, but it was as if I found a calling. I mean, how could I ignore this? And the doctors were callous. The aides were callous. There was just no love in the place at all. And I can tell that even though I didn't really have much experience growing up with love, I could feel that what was missing was love, was care, was nurturing. It was so clear. And then I became a leader of the program and the leader of the program. I ended up starting a book about the program that and several of us ended up writing.
Was this pre or post your medical training?
This is high college.
This is college. This is
Harvard, okay. Harvard College. I was traveling around the country with Harvard professors. I mean, college, sophomore, junior college, and giving lectures on volunteers. And I confronted the state hospital superintendent. And where this chutzpah comes from, I don't know. And I said, look, we have a social worker that will supervise 15 of us. We had 200 students, painting walls, running parties, taking people for walks. I said, but we each like our own student. We'll call ourselves case aides or volunteer aides. And we think we could help them if we saw each student, our own patient once a week. We wouldn't be there in the summers. I would be. I was there every summer, but we might not be there Christmas. I was there most Christmases. But not all the students were going to be there all the time like I was. And he got very balky about it. The president of the Boston Psychoanalytic Association said we ruined the patients. Here I'm 18, 19 years old. I'm looking at these people. They're crazy. How are we going to ruin the patients? And besides, I've never seen a psychoanalyst on the wards. So I enter into this Alice in Wonderland, but I had this conviction that these were people. They were no different than me. And I threatened to take the program to Boston State Hospital. I was at Metropolitan State, it was not pleasant, but finally the superintendent said, all right, you can have your program. And they picked the patients we couldn't hurt, and they assigned us each a patient. We had about, I think, 12, 15 students. I write up this is how my book Toxic Psychiatry, which is, I think, one of my best, how it begins with this story. And we ended up getting almost every patient out of the hospital. I mean, we got them placed in different places that were much better. We got some back with their families. And so it was so clear to me that this was the way to go. And because I had keys, I took the keys from the nurse's station one day, and they must have assumed that the superintendent gave them to me or something. And so I had keys the whole time, and I would go where I wanted. And I watched electroshock and insulin coma shock, where people would come in, they'd give them overdoses of insulin, send them into coma, they'd be frothing at the mouth, unconscious, having seizures, and getting ready to die, literally. And then they would give them orange juice or sugar water, and they would come alert again. And it was so clear to me what was going on. The people would come in full of energy, angry, depressed, anxious, but people, and then, and often resistant. They didn't want this, and they'd be pulled down or be done to them. They'd get this injection of insulin, knock them out, killing them, really, basically. And but when they came awake, they were like puppies. They were grateful. They said, thank you, I feel like you saved me. And they'd be, and they'd be docile. So it was very clear to me. I'm 18 years old. I haven't been trained. There was no fooling about what this was. I knew exactly what it was. I knew what shock treatment was. And then I saw lobotomy patients. Shock treatment, by the way, is electrodes. We still do this. I've been fighting this. We're still doing it. Had some recent successes, but which I might get to tell about. But it's where they put electrodes on the forehead of the brain, usually, sometimes different places, but always one of them is over the frontal lobes. And you get the shock of a voltage far beyond the wall. I mean, they go up to 400 volts or more, and the amperage is huge. It's fixed now at 800, 900 milliamps. That's 10 times what you need at times to give a convulsion. So they're blasting the brain way beyond what it needs to give the convulsion. And it makes docility. And it makes people out of touch with themselves. It makes people unable to complain. And often, as I go through the medical records, I do a lot of legal work around these areas, and I go through the medical records, and the cure is when the nurse writes no longer complaining, or the doctor writes mood elevated, which is the artificial euphoria of brain damage. This is very brain damaging. So I saw all this, and I decided, well, there's a place for me in psychiatry. I'm working with Harvard doctors. I'm talking at conferences. I got a book being written, an article being published, very young. So I go to medical school in order to have the right trade union to do this work. I knew it was the right trade union rather than say psychology. So it was my father actually who seldom spoke. And I said, Dad, I want to go and I want to do work in these hospitals and I want to help reform this profession. And I'm, you know, I'm actually having an impact already. And but I'm not sure what graduate school to go to. And he said, well, son, who has the strongest trade union? I was clear. So I went to medical school. I wasn't sure I could even pass medical school. It wasn't where my interest was, but I worked. And I, you know, for the first time in my life, I studied every day. And then I got through med school, did well in med school. And I didn't yet see that things were drastically changing. That would happen a little later. I went to Harvard for part of my residency in 1962-63, and Harvard had changed overnight. This is so important for history. I went there. I'd already done an interview. I'd been interviewed by a family therapist. I thought I was going to be doing a lot of therapy. I already knew the research director because I had actually visited with him and talked with him as the volunteer leader from the Harvard Radcliffe Mental Hospital Volunteer Program. Jerry Clareman. Jerry would later become one of the most high-ranking psychiatrists in the federal government and a professor at Harvard, full professor, you know, real big deal. He helped shape psychiatry. But Jerry at this point was, you know, second tier at the Harvard Training Center. And he said, what are you interested in, Peter? We knew each other. I said, well, I want to continue learning about human personality and psychology and how to help people grow, become stronger and overcome the things that are afflicting them. And he laughed. He said, that's not what we're going to be doing, Peter. We're going to be giving medications and we're going to be using computers to decide which ones to choose. This is 1963. And I said, well, Jerry, that's not the direction I want to go in. He said, well, you won't get anywhere then. And that was it. And we talked and I was in the program for a year. And I realized this is not going anywhere. These Harvard kids who were on the ward trying to help patients had no idea how to do it. And I knew because I sat with many and walked with many very disturbed people for sometimes more than I studied when I was at Harvard. And so I left Harvard. And by the way, I was the only person ever left Harvard after his first year. And the director called me and said, you can't leave. You're doing a good job, but you know, you can't be a professor yet, Peter. And I said, well, I think I'm going to go back to where I interned with Thomas Sass at the New Upstate Medical Center. And he was very disturbed that I was leaving. And I left and they welcomed me there. I'd had my internship there. And Tom Zoss was there, and he'd written a book called The Myth of the Mental Illness. But when I got back to Syracuse, Upstate Medical Center is what it really was in Syracuse, Zoss, after publishing The Myth of Mental Illness, was under huge attack. I'm right in the middle of this political assault. They're trying to fire Zoss. It's a state mental hospital that he's teaching in. They won't let him do that anymore. He can't break through there, but they can't get him fired. And I'm the one resident who says, well, you know, I believe in what Zoss is doing, but I fortunately didn't get fired and I got a good record. And then I went on to the National Institute of Mental Health because I was, you know, at the top, and I went into the U.S. National Health Service as an officer for 2 years. And I went to stationed at NIMH. And there I saw clearly what was happening. Psychiatry was leaving the psychosocial model behind. And my volunteer program had already been described by the last big federal commission on mental health. It's mentioned 2-3 times and described as one of the solutions to the vast mental hospital problems. It was a big last psychosocial report. Never had one again from the federal government. And nothing about drugging and shocking people in it. It was much more real, much more about what's really going on with human beings and human suffering, which is spiritual, psychological. Mm-hmm. And I could just see this writing on the wall, and I was not sure what to do. I was invited to stay at the National Institute of Mental Health. I accepted briefly in the child division. I was very interested in helping children. Then I thought, I can't do this. And I gave them warning without even having a job that I was leaving. I didn't know what else to do, so I went into private practice. And, you know, I thought private practice was selfish. That's not helping enough people. You have to change the world. You know, I wanted to do things. But then I thought, well, no, I'll go into private practice and help people. And that's what I was doing without medication. I treated everyone. You could come out of a hospital hallucinating. I'd help you come off the meds, and I'd relate to you. I learned very quickly that the most disturbed people would calm down and relate when somebody cared about them, wasn't afraid of them, was interested in them, made no pretense of being superior to them, didn't act like, oh, I never had anything happen to me bad. I didn't wear a suit. I had long hair. It was 1968, 69, 70. And that's what I was doing. I wrote a novel. I had 2 published novels eventually.
Let me interrupt you there for a moment, because I think it's an extraordinary point and really quite unusual that you were the rare psychiatrist who absolutely refused to use medications, at least initially. And then the ones who were on medication, you were put them on an aggressive strategy to get them off of the medication. So that was, drugs were not part of your modality, never have been, which is
right. It wasn't even a change of mind or anything. I knew from 18 years old, looking at what was going on in the wars, that people were just being drugged to stifle them. It was put them out of touch with themselves. Maybe it eased suffering, but at the expense of their brains. I could just tell that. And then in my residency, that became clearer to me. I treated as many people as I could without the meds. Yeah. I kind of interrupted you as you started. I really got off talking. I almost never
No. So. You were talking. it was just a really important point I wanted to emphasize. And really, one of your most incredible strategies as a physician to actually achieve this type of success without medications. And you've actually written books about this, too. Give many lectures.
Yeah. Lots of books and lectures. A huge YouTube channel, too. Yeah. One of the things I found in my residency, I was the first resident to start doing family therapy in both Harvard and the Upstate Medical Center. And I remember a woman who came in, and She was so horribly depressed, you know, that everybody said it was biological. Even then, there's never been any science for it. They've just always said it because we're physicians, so it's biologic. And I couldn't get through to her, and that was rare. I used to calm people down who were manic. I used to help people who were very paranoid calm down. So in the mornings that they didn't get drugged up, and I could, you know, just work with them. And I couldn't help this woman. And the director of the hospital, he said, well, look, Peter, you know, we got to get a star on some meds, or she's going to get shocked or go to the state hospital. I said to myself, I'm going to have a family session. So I called the family and I said, you know, this is not under my control anymore. And I said to the husband, your wife could get up being shipped to the state hospital. And I said, let's bring in members of the family. Like, I understand her sister and her mother care about it. Let's bring them in. So we had a family meeting, and this woman had never spoken, literally. And was sitting there, and the husband says, I'll take her home right now. And she says, no, I'm not going to let you do those things to me anymore. Well, there's this shock in the room. And the husband says, I'm taking you home. And maybe the father, her father was there. Some family member was there. We're talking about 1963 or four. And the family said, no, we'll take her home. And I said, yes, I'm in charge here, and I would discharge her now, because I don't want to go into the state hospital, into the care of the family, and please promise to come back next week. And I worked with her. A few days later, the husband came in, and he actually charged down the central hallway to attack me. And I'm a mighty 5'5", probably 135 pounds at the time, but I played football, and I could look huge. I got huge. He turned around right out of the hospital. Oh, Lord. I don't know where it came from. And she did great. She was no longer psychotic when I saw her a week later. Maybe underneath of all kinds of things going on, but she was functioning with her family, living with her sister. It was just so clear to me this was all about people, not about diseases. But leaping ahead. So I'm in private practice for 2 years. My practice is full. I'm doing family and couples work whenever I can. Probably no one else in DC is even doing it at that point. I'm not sure. And I'm learning that, you know, heal families. You heal with the individuals. Heal families. And even if mom and dad didn't abuse the child, maybe that's not even why the child is having so much trouble. Mom and dad can heal the child if you help them. You help them learn to love and do a modest amount of discipline. Love and discipline. We have to do that with each other. My wife disciplines me. If I get upset, I tell her what I'd like changed, and we love each other. It's a combination. You hold each other responsible for, you know, a good relationship, and you love, and that heals. Heal me. And I'm in the middle of this, and I read that lobotomy is coming back, that there's been an international association meeting in Copenhagen of psychosurgeons. Walter Freeman was an American psychosurgeon. Psychosurgery is any intrusion into the brain in which you actually intrude, in contrast to shock, where you put the stuff on the outside of the head. And they were inserting electrodes in people's heads, stimulating them to sort of toy with them, called it experimentation, it was toying, and then burning holes in heads. And I was unknown at the time, pretty much. I'd published a few articles, but they weren't that extremely controversial. They talked about freedom and responsibility, and some people got mad about it, but I wasn't well known. And I'd written a novel and pretty much unread at the time, a good publisher. So I wrote to everybody whose name was in the write-up about this big meeting about the brain. People, they were cutting into the brain. They were putting radium chips to kill brain tissue. I mean, anything I could think of to harm the brain that they thought they liked to do. I mean, that's what
it was. Would they actually insert ice picks through the nasal cavity?
Yeah, well, that was close to what Walter Freeman was doing, who was the honored at this meeting. He was very big at the meeting. Walter had gone around America in an RV from state hospital to state hospital, putting on shows in their amphitheaters. And the show was that he would insert an ice pick around the eyeball, not the nasal, but I imagine that could have been done that way, around the eyeball where the bone is.